his mother, who gave him up to foster care when he was a very young boy. We don't know why. And this will be the first time he's seen her in almost 50 years. The chapter begins with a diary entry by his mother, written before she gave him up. Peter's arrived in the town nearest to where his mother lives and is about to set off on the final leg of his journey. In the diary entry, Jack is Peter's piano teacher and Wendy is a friend of his mother's. 25th of July, 1961, late. The concert was wonderful. P was on second after a girl who fluffed the beginning of her piece, felt sorry for her, but she got it together and played quite nicely. P, of course, was note perfect. He was much younger than all the other children, and they had to put the stool on a crate of some sort. I was sitting over on the left of the hall, quite near the front, so I got a good view. The concentration. Jack turned the pages for one piece that he hadn't learned off by heart, and there was so much applause they did an encore together as a duet, the theme from Listen with Mother. I found that really difficult because it's the first time I've seen P and Jack so close, but I gritted my teeth. I didn't see Wendy in the hall, but when we left she was standing at the back. I introduced her to P, but he was tired and fidgety and not very talkative. Peter sits for a while, smoking, sipping at his sharp, dark coffee, enjoying the sensation of the short gusts of wind that pick up and fall away as they rustle his hair and brush against his face. He watches as a thin, ancient lady, supported on the arm of a woman he supposes to be her daughter, gurns silently with toothless gums, her grey eyes leaking tears over blue-veined cheeks. He watches a group of lads in track pants and trainers chatting and gesticulating in front of a local newspaper poster which, in bold capitals, announces "Une vache est tombée dans une piscine à Donville-sur-Mer." He watches as the assistant who served him in the patisserie steps from the shop and lights a thin brown cigarette, cupping it against the wind with hands the colour of milk. All these people to whom he's a stranger, who know nothing of him. He is, he realises, utterly free to be anyone he wants to be, to do anything he might want to do. That is not, though, how he feels. He feels like a child being dragged by a parent along the street, desperate to get away, to be let alone. He'd been thinking about going to have the test since that night, or rather the knowledge that there was a test and that he should take it had been in his mind like an ache that he couldn't shift, an ache that swelled and subsided and swelled again. Each time he was feeling not quite right, when his body felt off balance, he thought, it's that thing. And he could see the letters in his head, but he never said them out loud. And when he thought them, they pulled in and out of focus and swayed like kelp, lilting to the left and to the right, never fixing. And just when he thought he'd got them to stay still, so that he could hold them there, confront them, they'd slide away sideways, out of reach. And what, he'd thought for a long time, is the point. Either it's there inside me and I can't do anything about that, or it's not. And more than that, he'd thought, I don't want to know this about myself. It's too much to know. And he'd lie wakeful in bed, alert to the hiss of the wind in the trees, and his heart would start thumping, ka-dung, ka-dung, ka-dung. And he'd turn this way, then that, pulling a pillow between his side and his arm to muffle the pumping. But still it sounded, an incessant and terrifying pulsing, forcing his blood through his brain and his arms and his legs, and there'd be an ache in his groin that wasn't there before, a dull pressure that would become all he could think about, because that's what they said, wasn't it? That your lymph nodes swell, trying to fight it off, in your neck, in your armpits, between your legs, all those white blood cells swarming, trying to deal with this thing that tricked them and sidled off, waiting, replicating, filling you up, making you weak and unable to fight until it was too late. And your skin came out in purple lesions and you got pneumonia and they filled you with chemicals while you wasted in a bed where no one came to see you. And you died even though you were somehow already dead, like a zombie, because the virus was a signifier of your mortality. And nobody could see it until your cheeks hollowed and your eyes fell back into their sockets like marbles in quicksand. And still the wind hissed as it brushed the leaves of the trees while his heart beat hard in its cage, ka-dung, 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 and still he could not stop the sound of it. He could not stop the sound. Back at the car, he wipes a disemboweled fly from the windscreen with a spit-damped hanky. It's about 5 kilometres from here to Sellouville. The road takes him through a small modern estate of identical cream-painted houses, across a low concrete bridge that traverses a slow, looping river, past a group of wooden farm buildings, and then out into open countryside. He's very close to the sea now. He senses it in the air, in the quality of the light. There's an invisible rim of clarity that traces the silhouettes of the oak trees and the apple, their boughs bowed with straggling orbs of mistletoe, the sharp lines of the zinc water troughs, the muscled rumps of the slowly munching cows. Their sharpness is unreal. He comes to a three-way junction with no markings, no signposts. He stops the car. It could be either road. His map doesn't help. He turns off the engine and gets out. He must be very close. The directions she'd sent him said to take the turning out of La Cloche, that the house was a little less than a kilometre outside the village, on the right of the road that he would be coming in on, that if he ended up in Sellouville itself, he'd gone too far and to turn back. The house would then, because of the sight line from that direction, be more easily visible on the left, set back from the road up a narrow gated drive. "You'll know it when you see it," she'd written. "It looks like a child's drawing of a house. If you took a rope and wrapped it round the world, it would get wet, Peter." Him with his mother, her life and her joy, her little bundle of, "Oh, I could eat you all up," sitting at a table in a house that looks like a child's drawing of a house. But, and where will you get a piece of rope that long? She's darning a sock, humming. "You could tie bits together, or you could go to a smaller bit of the world to start off, like up at where the North Pole is." An injured butterfly is flapping intermittently on the windowsill above the sink, the sun catching the powder that erupts from its serrated wing. "Mummy?" "Yes, darling?" "I don't want to go to my piano lesson today." He looks at the two roads, which to take. He steps up onto a large stone embedded in the verge by the side of the road and peers over a hedge thick with ivy. At first he doesn't see it because there's a line of trees stretching in a rough diagonal, partially blocking the view. But it's definitely there, plain stone flat-fronted. There's a thin wisp of smoke rising from a chimney on the far side, blowing towards what must be the river he crossed earlier. He can just make out the crowns of some willows. There's very little sound, just the shush of the wind in the upper branches of the trees, the deep, insistent caw of a distant crow. He closes his eyes and breathes deeply. The wind picks up for a moment and falls back. He takes the letter from his pocket. "Les Saules, Sellouville, Manche, February the 12th. Dear Peter, it is time, I think, to meet. I won't waste words here that would be better spoken and which you may choose not to read. I've not been well recently and there are things to resolve, explanations to be given. If you do not want to come, I would of course understand, but in that event a card or letter letting me know that you are well and happy would be a consolation. I will send directions and we can agree dates if you reply. There's a spare room here, a comfy one at the back of the house overlooking the garden with a view across the fields to the river. It's very peaceful and in spring quite beautiful. I hope you can drive. We are unreachable without a car. Let me know your thoughts as soon as you're able. If I do not hear back within a fortnight, I shall assume that your life is not one that needs this disruption." It isn't signed, which of course it couldn't be, not now, not after all this time. Mother? Mummy? Either would be absurd. He understands the name of the house now, Les Saules, the Willows. He wonders whether it's always been called that or whether it was her choice. They would sometimes sit under the willows in the park, the picnic blanket half in, half out of the shade, and he would run around in circles feeding old bread from a paper bag to the ducks while she lay back with her legs in the sun, her head resting on a folded cardigan, pulling a hand through the branches. The same hand that wrote this, in violet ink, on this paper. A hand that is about to be extended towards him, to touch his. He traces the words with his fingers. He cannot remember her hands. She must, of course, have held him, wiped his mouth, touched his hair, stroked his face. She had held him as a baby and suckled him, soothed him, rubbed his back as he lay against her after feeding. She had changed his nappy, rubbed creams and ointments into the sensitive skin between his legs as he wriggled and peed and cried and gurgled. She had held his hands and with her own had kneaded them into the dough for the bread they sometimes made on Saturdays, placed her own over his when they stirred the cake mix in the great creamware bowl with the wooden spoon that always smelled damp and sweet and oniony, however hard she scrubbed it. With her hands she had done all these things, but what those hands looked like, how they felt, he realizes he has no idea. He thinks that her nails were probably cut short. Long ones would have got in the way of the hand sewing she took in for extra money and of the embroidery she did for pleasure. He pictures her tugging at the threads on the underside of a sheet of what must have been muslin, a moon of material from where he used to sit reading, leaning back against her legs as she clucked and hummed and stitched, as she drew the silk, scarlet, purple, orange, gold, through the material with the thick silver needle she kept in the ladybird pincushion with the shining silver sides. He starts to replace the letter in his pocket, but even as he does so, time is slowing down, as if it has a weight, a mass, and everything is at once thick and syrupy and unreal. He can see that he has the letter between his fingers, but they're someone else's. His arms feel heavy, his blood soupy. His fingers tingle. There's a taste of metal and pencils in his mouth. He tries to swallow but can't. His heart is pounding, ka-dung, ka-dung, and thin stripes of electricity race up his legs, flash and are gone. It's okay, he thinks. I can deal with this. I've managed before. He breathes deeply, slowly, tries to imagine something calm and quiet, a flat, pale surface, something to distract attention from the looping feedback that's fizzing and sparking beneath his skin. He needs to make his brain work to concentrate on something he can describe out loud, but he can't see a flat, pale surface, can only see small violet spiders scuttling across the paper. It's not spiders, it's just letters, not spiders, he says to himself, and then aloud, I can see P's and T's and C's, they're just letters on a piece of paper. And the letter has been written on cream paper, which if I stroke it with my fingertips, will be smooth and thick and dry. And I'm holding the paper in my right hand, which is just here on the end of my arm, and I can move my arm by thinking it, and I'm okay. And they're not spiders, and they can't hurt me, and I'm fine, absolutely fine. And I can breathe there, and breathe there. And my heart is fine, and I'm not dying, and it's just my mother, and she can't hurt me, and I can leave whenever I want to, and I'm going to be okay. It's going to be okay. He opens his eyes and finds that he's leaning with his back against the side of the car. The crow has stopped its cawing, and in its place there is nothing but the curdled coo of a wood pigeon. He concentrates on the resonance of the distant sound, imagines the softness of the fine grey-green feathers on its chest. His breathing is calmer now, the taste in his mouth less bitter. The cooing of the pigeon is, at this moment, right here, the most perfect music. There's a path to the house from the gate. It leads through the middle of a garden that must once have been tended. Beds of red-black, weed-filled earth encircle stunted fruit bushes. The grass is clumpy and overgrown. There are what look like some dead apple trees and a border with a few sad shrubs. In the far corner is a pile of something covered in a stained grey tarpaulin, a corner of which flaps against the grass like a dying fish. He walks up the path quickly, quietly, hopes she's not watching from a window, does not look up. The bell is operated by a pull, which hangs like a black icicle by the side of the door. Where the paint has flaked, rust has formed irregular patches of the most vivid orange. He places a finger against one of the patches and traces its outline, feeling the crust where the smooth paint gives way to the rough metal. It needs retouching. He could do that. He will offer over tea, perhaps, and a cake. Pretend that it was something he's only just thought of. She'll appreciate such a gesture, and perhaps she's put off repainting it because she's always known that the day would come when that job could be done by him. That bell pull, he'll say casually, and she'll smile, and there'll be a small tin of black gloss paint in an understairs cupboard, and he can spend an afternoon sanding it down and making it perfect, and she'll come out when it's finished, he won't let her see it till then, and clasp her hands and beam with pleasure. What on earth is he thinking? He pulls on the bell. Silence. He knocks. The rap of his knuckle echoes in a hall he can already picture. Tiled floor, plaster walls, a water-damaged mirror in a cracked gilt frame. He waits for footsteps that don't come. Could she be out? He checks his watch. Perhaps she went shopping and is on her way back. She will have a small car, one of those old Citroëns perhaps. It may have broken down, or not that, it's a reliable car, regularly serviced. She's been caught in conversation with a shopkeeper, has already checked the time, made her excuses and is making her way back, too fast along the narrow twisting roads. My son, she will have said, from England. And the shopkeeper will have nodded, shooing her out of the door, apologising for making her late. We don't use the front door. The voice is faint, an echo of the words before they were spoken. He turns, and there she is, a few feet away, a short woman in a dark wool coat and gumboots. There's a gap between the tops of the boots and her coat, and what he thinks, the first thing he thinks, is that she should be wearing trousers, that her legs, which are pale and blue and rickety thin, must be very cold.